Good morning, family. I want you to imagine that you are standing at the edge of a 20-foot cliff. I'm standing here because it's a high stage, so kind of get the picture. 20 foot below is a shimmering sea, and the water looks beautiful and refreshing. It's hot outside, and you think that now might be the perfect time to practice your dive. The only question is if the water is deep enough. If it is, it's fine. And you can make it and you can enjoy the cool, refreshing water, no problem. But if it's not, the result could be paralysis or death. And you tell yourself, YOLO, which if you don't know what that means, you only live once. So you're about to dive, and out of the corner of your peripheral vision, you see an old man with a limp and scars all over his face. And he yells to you, "Don't jump!" And he tells you the story of years ago, how he had been in the same position as you, and how he dove to the bottom and nearly lost his life in the process. That man is the voice of Ecclesiastes. In the book of Ecclesiastes, the preacher, most likely King Solomon, is a man who has practiced his dive, as it were, into countless pools, diving into pools, searching for meaning, and finding in pool after pool after pool that there is not enough here for satisfaction. That meaning and purpose and joy cannot be found here. Solomon dove deep and hit the bottom. And in our passage this morning, he's not trying to shame us for all the things that we look to and chase after to try to find meaning. What he's trying to do, what he's pleading for us to do, is to not waste our lives. To not waste your life diving into shallow pools searching for meaning. The big idea that I hope to communicate from our passage this morning with God's help is that meaning in this life cannot be found from this life. Three main themes we're going to develop from the passage we just heard read a few moments ago. First, we're going to consider the pursuit of meaning under the sun. Then we'll consider the problem with meaning under the sun. And then finally conclude with a prescription, or the prescription for meaning under the sun. Now here's my challenge to you hearing my voice this morning. Don't be like the fool at the edge of the cliff who hears a warning from someone else and decides to jump anyways. Don't say to yourself, "I'm the exception. It would be different if it was me." Listen to the voice of wisdom. Listen to a loving God who loves you enough to come to you in the voice of the preacher in Ecclesiastes and warn you about the dangers of looking for shallow happiness when God offers you deep joy. Let's begin by considering Solomon's pursuit of meaning under the sun. Now, I'm just going to warn you right off the top of the bat, we're going to spend the most of our time here. I'm telling you this because if it's getting really, really close to lunchtime and we're still on point one, you just remember I warned you, okay? We've got other work to do, but we've got a lot of work to do right here considering Solomon's pursuit of meaning. And Solomon, we can divide his pursuit into two main categories. Maybe you picked up on these as Pastor Mike read the passage a few moments ago. On the one hand, Solomon looks for meaning in knowledge or wisdom. One way to try to find meaning and purpose is to know a bunch of stuff. to kind of figure out the mysteries of life. And the other path that Solomon pursues is the path of pleasure. And Solomon wants to warn both of us, all of us, that both of those paths are not a path for meaning. Let's begin by considering the pursuit of meaning by pursuing knowledge. Look with me at chapter 1, verses 12 through 18. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. Let's stop there. He's not just trying to figure out some things. He's not trying to be an expert in one field. He's saying, I'm going to apply my heart to search out everything, to figure all of it out. How's that going to work out for Solomon? It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Verse 14, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. We were walking through this passage in family worship with our kids last night, and one of our kids asked, what do you mean chase after wind? How do you chase after wind? You can't catch it. And that's the point. Solomon says, I'm chasing after knowledge and trying to find meaning by knowing stuff, and I can't ever arrive. Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over at Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. Why, Solomon? Because, verse 18, in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. In these verses, we find one of the reasons why many believe, and historically Christians have believed, that Solomon is the author of Ecclesiastes. He talks about acquiring wisdom more than anyone else that was ever before him, and we understand from the books in the Old Testament that Solomon was the wisest sinner who ever lived. Sometimes when you look at the life of Solomon, you begin to wonder, could he really be that wise? I want to talk about some of the ways that he foolishly pursued happiness through pleasure. We know his failures are kind of legendary, and we look at Solomon's life and we wonder, how could he really be that wise? I think perhaps that ought to be for us an invitation to look in the mirror and realize that we are a lot less wise than we think. Solomon's point in verses 12 to 18 is very simple. You cannot find meaning in life by pursuing knowledge. And we can summarize a few reasons for that. To save you from diving into the pool looking for meaning through information. One reason why knowledge is not the path for meaning or purpose is because there's always more to learn. It's like chasing after the wind. You never catch it. You may be the smartest person in this room. Somebody is. I don't know who it is, but somebody in this room is smarter than everybody else. Just logically, it makes sense, right? Guaranteed, smartest person in the room, whoever you are, somebody in here knows a lot more about something than you do. Guaranteed. There's always more to learn. Solomon says, knowledge, learning things, cannot be the path to satisfaction, the path to joy, the path to purpose, because it's like running on a treadmill. There's always more, and the longer you live, the more there is that you don't know. I was hanging out with the young boys during VBS. Holly and I worked with 10 to 12-year-old boys during Vacation Bible School, boys and girls. And I sat down talking with the boys at the table every night at dinner, and they were using words I didn't understand. I mean, I'm not joking. They were saying things. I didn't think they were speaking English. and they were talking to me about these YouTube characters and these videos and all this stuff. And I constantly was asking them, what does that mean? What is that about? Tell me about this, because I didn't understand it. And the longer you live, you will find that to be more and more true. You cannot find the end to the path of knowledge. There's always more to know. So Solomon says it's vanity. Another reason why knowledge is not the path to meaning and purpose in life is because knowledge is not the same thing as control. We say knowledge is power, but it isn't. Solomon in verse 15 says, what is crooked cannot be made straight. In other words, just because you know how something works doesn't mean that you control it. Knowing what causes cancer will not protect you from getting it. Knowing the environmental conditions that form a hurricane or a tornado or a tsunami will not protect you from being destroyed by one. Knowing the psychological profile of a mass murderer will not protect you from becoming one of his victims. And yet, we constantly try to figure out why. When there's a shooting somewhere where everyone's asking why. Why did he do this? And Solomon says, listen, what is crooked cannot be made straight. You cannot control your life by learning more information. That's not the way to have control. And so pursuing meaning by chasing after knowledge will ultimately leave you with a lot of information and no way to escape the suffering that life still brings your way. Another reason why knowledge is not the path to meaning in this life is because knowledge often leads to heartache. Look at verse 18 again. In much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Some of you could have used that verse as your theme verse when you were in school as a young child. Knowledge leads to vexation and sorrow. It's true, isn't it? With a few clicks or swipes on your phone or tablet, you can learn information about the most devastating tragedies all over the world. Think about it. 100 years ago, 200 years ago, you had to wait for information to travel and get to you, and you eventually would learn about a horrible thing that happened on the other side of the world. Now, you can watch people live tweeting about it as it's happening. We have all kinds of information, all kinds of knowledge. Let me ask you, 21st century people, are we happier? I think you could argue that we are the most anxious and depressed generation in all of human history. Why? Because we have so much information and we can't control what happens and we can't do anything about it. Knowing does not solve life's problems. Now, to the young people in this room, some of you are in school and you're maybe really loving this section of Ecclesiastes. This is great. I've got a Bible verse I can quote to mom when she tells me to do my homework. Well, the Bible is honest about knowledge, but it's not anti-knowledge. Solomon's point is not that you should give up on trying to learn anything. He's just saying, don't look for meaning and purpose in learning things. Yet wisdom, knowledge is still important. Jump ahead with me to chapter 2, beginning in verse 12. He says, so I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. If you're going to hike a mountain, is it better to hike it with your eyes open or closed? Preferably open, right? And yet, you can hike that mountain, and even with your eyes open, you could still get struck by lightning, or succumb to an avalanche, or get attacked by a grizzly bear. Solomon's not saying knowledge, wisdom aren't helpful in this life. He's just saying they're not going to solve all of your problems. He's not endorsing being a fool. Knowledge is better than folly. Wisdom is better than folly. But wisdom, knowledge, information by itself won't save you. You can be a well-educated fool on your way to hell. And yet, knowledge, wisdom, information might just help your experience along the way to be a little bit better. For example, if you live your life wisely and you don't spend money that you don't have, you'll have a generally better experience than the person that continues to rack up debt. Or if you abstain from addictive habits, destructive habits, you will generally have a more happy life along the way. Wisdom, knowledge by itself is helpful, but it's not the place where meaning is found, where purpose is found. So the young people, I would say, work hard and study hard, but don't think that by studying and doing well in school that you will find the answers to life. That's the path of knowledge. Consider with me the second path that Solomon chases down looking for meaning, and that's the path of pleasure. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. Let's take a quick poll of the room. Time for honesty. How many of you have ever daydreamed about winning the lottery? You ever daydreamed about winning the lottery? Yeah. Some of you are happy about it. Others of you are lying. Most of us have at least at some point in life just thought, what would I do with $1 million, $10 million, $100 million? What would I do with all that cash? Solomon didn't have to daydream. He didn't have to stop and think. Solomon had all the cash you could ever imagine at his disposal, and he embarked on this incredible quest for meaning through various types of pleasure, diving in one pool after another, looking for something that satisfies. And what an experiment it was. Look at verses 2-9. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I search with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. We can trace from those verses several pools that Solomon dives into looking for satisfaction, looking for purpose, looking for meaning. The first is laughter. Verse 2, he says, he said of laughter, it is mad, of pleasure, what use is it?
Some people think perhaps Solomon here is talking about a kind of a lighthearted approach to life. You think of Marie Antoinette, who when she heard that her citizens were hungry, she said, "Let them eat cake." Maybe that's kind of the idea, lighthearted approach to life. Or perhaps Solomon got all the comedians. You know, the Jerry Seinfelds of his day and the Nate Bargatzes and the Jim Gaffigans, come on and make me laugh. Whatever it was, it wasn't the answer. So he tried alcohol. Verse 3, but Solomon, when he says, "My heart was still guiding me with wisdom," I think what he means is that he's a connoisseur. He's a top shelf drinker. He's not just getting slammed by 10 or 11 a.m. He's drinking the best and doing so in such a way that he can still enjoy what it is that he's drinking. And yet that's not the answer. Verses 4 to 7, he pursues meaning in luxury. First, he talks about the houses that he built. Not house, houses. Now, we know Solomon's greatest construction project was the temple. The temple took 7 years to build and 135,000 workers. 135,000 workers. And yet, Solomon's house took him twice as long to build as the temple. Imagine the house. And that's just one. He says he built houses. And then he talked about his landscaping. The older I get, maybe this is something that happens when you turn 40, all of a sudden I started caring about landscaping. I mean, beautiful grass. I didn't give a rip about that kind of stuff. Now I'm 40. I mean, I love good landscaping. I don't have it, but I like to look at it. Solomon's got it. He's got gardens and parks and orchards and vineyards and a sophisticated ancient irrigation system. This is incredible. Any of you that love working in the yard, Solomon's got it all. And he's got slaves. Now here, 21st century Americans, we would say, well, I wouldn't want slaves. And that's a good thing, but just imagine an entourage surrounding you, doing all the things that you hate doing yourself. Man, wouldn't it be nice to have your own personal barber shave your face, cut your hair? Ladies, your own personal cosmetician, did your makeup and your nails and your feet and all that stuff. Kids, wouldn't it be nice, kids, to have your very own personal butler? And they got your lunch, always with dessert. They cleaned your room for you, put away your dirty clothes. Wouldn't that be amazing to have people in your life that just did whatever you don't want to do? Like moving or putting together IKEA furniture. Or what about your own personal masseuse or a maid or a gardener or a chef or a personal assistant or a personal trainer or your own private security, chauffeurs, nannies, on and on and on. What if you had that? Don't call them slaves. Just call them your entourage. It does all the stuff that you don't want to do. Solomon's entourage may have been the greatest in world history. In 1 Kings chapter 4, we learned that the daily allotment of food for Solomon's house was enough to feed 35,000 people. Can you imagine never doing something you don't want to do ever again? That's Solomon. Luxury. And then, the end of that pool, Solomon decides that's not the answer, and so he pursues meaning and purpose and satisfaction in just having a lot of money, wealth. Verses 7 and 8, he talks about his livestock. Now, in that day, livestock was a measure of wealth. If you had a lot of cows, A lot of horses, a lot of oxen. You were rich. Solomon in 1 Kings 4 had 40,000 stalls for his horses and chariots. And he had 12,000 horsemen. In our day, this would be like a warehouse filled with all the best cars imaginable. Wouldn't that be amazing? Any amazing car you've ever seen in a movie, yours. Wealth, just incredible wealth. And it wasn't just the livestock. Solomon had fat stacks of cash. 1 Kings chapter 10 tells us he had 23 tons of gold brought into his house every single year. Now, according to ChatGPT, that's nearly $2 billion annually coming into your house. And by the way, that is just gold. The Bible says that in Solomon's day, silver was as common as stones. This man was absolutely loaded. And that wasn't the source of meaning, satisfaction. Some of us, I think, you tell yourself that it would be much easier to be at peace if you only had just a little bit more. Solomon's saying, I had it all, and I didn't have it. Solomon chased down another pool, and he dove into the pool of entertainment in verse 8. You know, we in our day, we have digital access to the best entertainment that the world has to offer. Solomon had something even better. He had physical access. Can you imagine your favorite artists, Taylor Swift, Metallica, whoever it is, and you can invite them into your home for a private concert whenever you want. You're the king. That's what Solomon had. Probably not Metallica, but something like it. And then in verse 8, he pursues pleasure by diving into the pool of sex. The word translated concubines in our English Bibles there in verse 8 is only used one time in the entire Bible. It's really hard to translate. Some scholars suggest that this is actually a crass word for female anatomy, which shows you just the depths of Solomon's depravity here. We know from 1 Kings chapter 11 that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, 1,000 women at his disposal. And he says, that's not the answer. And so he dives into the pool of fame. Verse 9, he became great and surpassed everybody that was before him. Unrivaled fame, the most popular man in the world. I think we sometimes lie to ourselves and we tell ourselves, I don't want to be famous. I don't want that kind of recognition. But look at how our brain starts firing off once we get a few likes on a post on social media. And tell yourself that you wouldn't enjoy that kind of recognition. Solomon had it, and he said it wasn't the answer. Now, before we consider Solomon's conclusion after having it all, I want you to stop and think for a moment about pleasure in this life. If you were with us last week, when we looked at the first half of chapter 1, the big idea we talked about last week was that life without God is all pain, no gain. But I want to make sure that you don't misunderstand that, because I'm not saying that there isn't pleasure to be found in this life. I'm just saying that none of it lasts. You see, Solomon, if you look at the text, Solomon is quite honest about the fact that he had a lot of fun doing all this. Look at chapter 2, verse 10. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. I did whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted, and I loved it. This is an important message, I think, for our young people to hear. Listen, if you're here and you're, let's say, south of 30, 35, listen to me. Sin is fun. It is. But it doesn't last. It's like drinking candy-flavored poison. It tastes good going down, but it destroys you. Parents, I don't think we help our children when we act as if sin isn't fun. Because it is. That's why we do it, isn't it? Why do you do it? Nobody's twisting your arm and making you sin. You do it because you want to. And the path of sin often leads to pleasure. Solomon's admitting that, and yet he's saying, zoom out just a bit and look at where this thing leads. And it will not bring you happiness. Young people, listen, you can leave this place and you can chase after everything the world says is worth chasing after. And you might have a lot of fun in the process, but in the end, you will die. The pleasure, we have pleasure in all sorts of things in this life, but none of the pleasure lasts. It's like eating a scoop of ice cream. You eat that scoop, it tasted great, but as soon as you're done, it's gone. And what do you want? Another scoop. I want some more. It reminds me of a scene from The Simpsons when Homer told Mr. Burns, "You're the richest man I know." And Mr. Burns replied, "Ah, yes, but I'd trade it all for a little more. A little more." So what's Solomon's conclusion to pursuing meaning through pleasure? Look at verse 11. "Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun." Paul's conclusion, or not Paul, Solomon's conclusion, I got Paul in my head for some reason. Solomon's conclusion in verse 14 and chapter 2, verse 11. It's the same. Pursuing knowledge is hevel. It's vanity. Pursuing pleasure is hevel. It's vanity. It's a vapor. It's like a frozen breath in the winter, or a bubble that's there for a second and then it's gone, or a puff of smoke. It's elusive. It's uncontrollable, because meaning in this life cannot be found from this life. So stop chasing satisfaction under the sun. That's the pursuit of meaning under the sun. Consider with me, number two, the problem. What's the problem with meaning under the sun? Solomon answers that question beginning in verse 14. "The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity." What is it that happens to wise people and foolish people, to rich people and poor people? What is it? We all die. What's the problem with pursuing meaning under the sun? Eventually, you will die, and everything under the sun that you were pursuing dies with you. That's what Solomon is saying. You know, if you were to take the bones of Einstein and Hugh Hefner and some average John Doe and just line them up side by side, the naked, untrained eye would not be able to tell the difference. It does not matter how much pleasure you have in this life, how much knowledge you gain in this life, if in the end you're going to die just like everybody else. Somebody might respond, well, at least I can live in a way where I leave a legacy. Maybe that's what I do. Maybe that's the path to meaning. Live in such a way that you leave a legacy for the people behind you. Solomon the preacher says, nope, tried that too. It doesn't work. Look at verses 16 and 17. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. There are a few people that are remembered long after they're gone, but it's only a few. And by the way, if you're not here to listen to the people remembering you, does it really even matter? What's the point? You don't hear it yourself. Who cares if you're remembered if you're not around to see it? Woody Allen once said, I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it by not dying. Maybe you hear that and you say, well, who's Woody Allen? And that's the point. The man's not even dead yet. And many of you don't know who he is. You will be forgotten. You're dismissed. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to try to end these things on a high note, Lord willing. This is a tragic reality. It's painful. It hurts. It's a dark path that Solomon is leading us down. What will happen, brother, sister, friend, to everything that you worked for in this life when you're gone? What will happen to it? Solomon invites us to consider what could happen to it in verses 18 to 23, chapter 2. He says, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What is a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation, and even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. Here's what the preacher is saying to us. You could spend your entire life building something, something that matters. Something you care about, something good, something important. You can spend your entire life building that thing. And when you're gone, you have zero control over what happens to it. You say, well, I can get a will, and I can put it in my will that it only goes to this person or that person. Can you control what they do with it? What if they're a fool? What if you spend your entire life building something beautiful and great and it goes to an absolute moron? That's what Solomon's asking. Howard Hughes died in 1976 as one of the richest men in the world. He had no direct descendants, no immediate relatives. But he insisted in his will that his great fortune did not go to some distant relative that he never even met. And yet after 7 years in court, his $2.5 billion estate was divided among 22 distant cousins. Solomon looks at that and he says, that's a great evil. You don't control what happens to everything you lived for, everything you built, when you die. And if you know the story of Solomon, you know that this is exactly what happened to Solomon. He brought the nation of Israel to its peak, built the temple, brought peace, and his son destroys it, and the kingdom is split. He left it all to a fool. Dear friend, so too might you when you die. These are hard things to consider. But if we're going to look at life honestly, we need to look at these truths in the face. Meaning in this life cannot be found from this life, because in the end, death is going to steal it all away from you. Maybe you hear that and you say, this is so depressing. I had the bright idea, once the pandemic hit in 2020, to preach through the book of Lamentations. Some of you remember that. You were here. My dear friend who's now with Jesus, Cliff Hall, towards the end of that sermon series, he said to me, if Lamentations had one more chapter, I'm going to jump off a cliff. Maybe you feel like that with Ecclesiastes. We're only in chapter 2. 10 more to go, folks. Buckle up. There is hope in these pages. If we zoom out and look beyond the bleak portrait that it paints, even in Solomon's words in chapter 2, there is great hope if we have eyes to see it. So consider with me finally the prescription for meaning under the sun. If you remember from our first sermon in this book, when Solomon talks about life under the sun, he's talking about life lived horizontally, without any reference vertically to the God who made this world. It's life only considering this material universe, not considering the Creator. What he wants us to do is get beyond the sun, get over the sun, look at the one who created the sun. And he invites us to do that. I want to show you three practical ways in our final few verses on how we can pursue true meaning in this life. First, we must remember the giver. Remember the giver. I think when we look at the hedonism in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, sometimes we lie to ourselves and we say the solution is to live a simple life. You know, don't be hedonistic. Live the simple life and then you'll find happiness. That's not the answer either. If it was, then poor people would never complain. They'd be happy. It's not about having more or less. It's about your perspective with what it is that you do have. Consider how Solomon instructs us in that in verses 24 and 25. He says, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Dear friend, if you're in this room and you're not a follower of Jesus, you will not find happiness under the sun. I think that God designed the universe in such a way that you're going to keep chasing it and never find it. You have to look beyond that. You have to look to the giver, as Solomon instructs us in these verses, to look and consider who it is that gave you all of these precious gifts that you enjoy. The only way to truly enjoy the gifts that God gives us under the sun is to love the giver more than the gifts, as our brother Chris prayed earlier in this service. If you're in this room and you're a follower of Jesus, you need to learn to keep God in mind as you enjoy the gifts that he has given you. Keep them in mind. Don't enjoy the gifts as if you earned them all by yourself. Don't enjoy the gifts forgetting the God who gave them to you. But remember him. Remember him. Praise him. If you wake up in the morning and you enjoy a beautiful cup of black coffee, praise King Jesus for creating coffee beans and creating someone smart enough to roast that thing and pour hot water over it. Whatever the gift is, stop and say, Jesus, thank you. Thank you. I couldn't enjoy this if you didn't give it to me. So remember the giver. The second prescription for meaning in this life is to remember the guardrails. Remember the guardrails. Let me read verse 26 and I'll tell you what I mean. He says, for to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Here's what Solomon's saying. There's two types of people in this life, those who please God with what they have and those who don't. If you will please God with the things that he has given you, in the end, you will receive even more. If you live for yourself, if your whole life is devoted to what you can get for you, then in the end, even what you have, Jesus says, will be taken from you. Are you pleasing God? So when I say remember the guardrails, what I'm inviting us to do is to enjoy the gifts that God has given us in the way that God has instructed us to enjoy them. You think through most of the gifts that Solomon recounts in chapter 2. Most of them are not sin in and of themselves. Is it a sin to have a beautiful, lush lawn? Well, if it's a sin, I'm fine. I don't got that. It's not a sin to have a beautifully manicured lawn. Is it a sin to ignore your family or gathering with God's people so that way you can continue to take care of that lawn? Yes. You've forgotten the guardrails. You've taken the gift and you've allowed it to rise to the point of God in your life. Is enjoying intimacy in marriage, is that wrong? No, but it is wrong to take the gift of sex and pull it outside of its God-ordained place. Fire is appropriate in a fireplace, but not on the carpet. And sex is right and good in a marriage between a man and a woman, but it's not okay anywhere else. The gifts that God has given us to enjoy are meant to be enjoyed according to the parameters that he has set, the guardrails that he has given. So as you enjoy these gifts, Christian, consider, am I doing it in a way that pleases God or not? Are you using your gifts properly? Are you idolizing them? Are you rejecting what God says about how to use these gifts? Are you considering what the scriptures say at all? Are you pleasing God with what he's given you? Now, before you answer yes, consider with me what the scripture says about pleasing God. Romans chapter 8, verse 8. Those who are in the flesh cannot please God. That's a sobering message when you compare it in light of Ecclesiastes 2:26. Because Solomon says, if you please God in this life, you'll have more awaiting you in the next. But what if you can't? What if, because of your sin, it's impossible for you to please God? Final prescription for happiness for us loved ones is to remember the gospel. Who is the only one who perfectly pleases God? The same one who heard a voice from heaven at his baptism. This is my beloved son in whom I am well, what? Pleased. Jesus had far less possessions and pleasurable experiences than his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa Solomon. And yet, Jesus never lost sight of the giver. Jesus never stepped outside of the guardrails. He never abused alcohol. He never hoarded his possessions. He never had a lustful thought. He was tempted in all ways as we are, yet without sin. Jesus was the only person in all of human history that could look at Ecclesiastes 2:26 and say, "That's me." And yet, instead of stockpiling more benefits and pleasure from God for his obedience, Jesus received the opposite. On the cross, Jesus received the stockpile of our sin piled upon him. Why? So that whoever turns from their sins and trusts in him can have eternal life and pleasure and satisfaction and meaning and joy in this life. All of that purchased for us at the cross of Calvary. As it turns out, there is a way to please God, but it's not by working for it. Hebrews 11 verse 6 says, "Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him." How do you please God? By trusting in Jesus. By following Jesus. By living in a way obedient to the word of Jesus. That and that alone is the only place where meaning can be found. Everything else is chasing after the wind. Would you pray with me? Father, we thank you for your beloved Son. Jesus, we thank you that you were faithful